Welcome, everybody. Did we miss anybody? And as you know, I'm Brian. And tonight what I wanted to do is I wanted to share with you some reflections about Buddhist ethics, about ethical living. You know, ethics really is about how we live, how we move forward in our lives in terms of our conduct. And I want to speak about it in terms of our current times. You know, the title I used was in this post-9/11 era. So tomorrow will mark 8 years since September 11th, 2001. It's been 8 years. I'm sure most of you can remember. Can you remember where you were when you first found out about the Twin Towers? Yeah, it's an indelible memory. It's really this clear memory that probably most of us have. Where I was is actually I was substitute teaching in Silver City, New Mexico at a high school, at the high school in Silver City there. And it was during one of the morning classes, and so we turned on the TV there. And what I was struck by, which I still remember, is you know, just going over in my head the memories or the reactions of the students. And it was surprising to see how many of the students had this reaction, this immediate reaction, immediately, of wanting to retaliate, right? So right then, I was beginning to notice how a violent act, an extremely violent act, engenders more violence. It begets more violence. And that was the beginning of it, right? It was right there. We need to attack back. And then, you know, in the days afterwards, and also I want to, you know, note on that day and in the following days, we did see, really witness some noble acts of heroism. I think there really was this coming together on one level in this nation, which I think was very moving. And there were, I think, a lot of things that came out of that situation that was truly noble, that was truly good. But also from the days and weeks and months and years after that, what else did we see? On the international level, I think it's pretty clear to say we saw basically a rather destructive foreign policy. So internationally, again, violence beginning violence. And also within this nation. The nation came together, but I think if we really examine it, it really divided the nation. So here we are. We live in these times ever since these past 8 years, where I think one of the qualities of this, what I'd call this post-9/11 era, is more and more we're able to witness this suffering on a global level, or I want to use this word global loosely, being able to see the suffering that goes well beyond just our immediate surroundings. And we saw that with 9/11 and then everything that's happened afterwards in so many different ways. And so tonight I want to offer you some reflections about acting in such a world that we live in, a world where we're more aware of suffering on this global level, of a suffering that extends out about beyond our immediate surroundings. And how do we act in such a world? How do we bring this practice forward in such a context, in such a situation? It's really what I want to explore with you tonight. And there's going to be a couple specific issues that I want to look at, more as examples of this kind of suffering. One is what I'd call intercultural or interracial suffering that happens on a scale that's bigger than our immediate surroundings. And then you can say ecological suffering or environmental suffering, the ecological crisis. And I'm hoping, though, that these, you know, a lot of these points extend far beyond just these two issues. I think one of the things that really excites me about Buddhism, especially about Buddhist ethics, is how fluid it is, how it's changed with the times. There's a real fluidity within Buddhism. For example, I think one way you can see that is just the way that the Buddha came up with the monastic code for his monks during the Buddha's times. It was really quite fascinating. He actually didn't start with a kind of principle. He didn't say, okay, this is going to be the principle that's regulating the monastic life, and from that principle, I'm going to come up with a code of rules. He didn't do that. Actually, they started without any rules. And then what he did is, when a situation arose, or something went awry, that's when he made a rule. So it was a very responsive way of making rules. Okay, oh, this situation happened, maybe we need some kind of guideline around this. Oh, another situation happens, let's make a guideline around this. So very contextual. So it's very practical, not philosophical, but practical, of what's going to help create this community that leads to awakening. What kind of conduct do monastics need? So I think it's in this spirit that I want to share with you these ideas. And I think it's time that you know, Buddhism has always changed when it's come into a different culture. And yet again, I think in this, what I'd call this post-9/11 era, it might be time for Buddhism to change once again, to really be able to respond to where we find ourselves right now. And I want to begin by sharing with you an essay that was written by a fellow by the name of Bhikkhu Bodhi. Bhikkhu Bodhi, I'm sure many of you have heard of his name. He's done a lot of translating. So he's a well-known Theravada monk, a very prolific writer. And he wrote this essay, I don't know, a few months ago, I think. And so I just want to share with you a couple of those of the things he says in that. He says, if Buddhism in the West becomes solely a means to pursue personal spiritual growth, I am apprehensive that it may evolve in a one-sided way and thus fulfill only half its potential. Attracting the affluent and the educated, it will provide a congenial home for the intellectual and cultural elite. But will risk turning the quest for enlightenment into a private journey that, in the face of the immense suffering which daily hounds countless human lives, can present only a resigned quietism. He goes on a little bit later to explain this a little bit in more detail. He says, the Buddha's mission, the reason for his arising in the world, was to free beings from the suffering by uprooting the evil roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. These roots don't exist only in our own minds. Today they have acquired a collective dimension and have spread out over whole countries and continents. To help free beings from suffering today, therefore, requires that we counter the systemic embodiments of greed, hatred, and delusion. Do you hear what he's saying? I just want to point out, this is very radical for a Theravada monk to be saying this too. But do you hear this? That I think he's affirming that our practice, for example, of meditation, of this what I would call this inward inquiry, is really important. But if it's only that, it's going to be one-sided. We're going to be neglecting being responsive to the world that we live in, the current world that we're living in. And that there's a kind of suffering that needs to be addressed. He uses this word, systemic suffering, that suffering that somehow reaches beyond just the individual. So it's a real calling. It's actually the title of this essay was A Challenge to Buddhists. He's really challenging Buddhism in the West to ask it to move forward. So again, the systemic suffering, these are our times. How do we respond? So difficult, right? How do we move forward? So again, it's going to be the same Dharma, but it's going to be embodying it differently. The same teachings, the same values that the Buddha gave us. but how are we going to embody it in this day and age? So just a few words about Buddhist ethics in general. You know, as Valerie was saying, you know, when the Buddha did teach, a lot of times that's how he would begin with, was he would begin by talking about generosity, and then once individuals or people started to get an understanding, a feel for generosity, then he would talk about ethical conduct. And ethical conduct is really important in this practice in terms of seeing the nature of reality, because when we live an ethical life, the mind is settled, right? It's settled and it's stable. When the mind is settled, it can see more clearly. Sometimes the image that's given is, it's like if you have a lake of water. If that water is settled, then it's easier to see very deeply into that body of water. If there's waves or if it's muddy, you're not going to be able to see very clearly. So in the same way, when we're living an ethical life, we're not going to be carrying around regrets or worries or fears as much. We can start to see more of the fundamental aspects of our experience, the fabric of our experience. So in that way, it really is the foundation of seeing things more clearly, of living a life that is leading towards awakening, leading towards liberation. But I think it's also important to remember that ethical conduct is not only the foundation, it's the manifestation of awakening. It's really the embodiment of liberation. I think this is important to understand. You know, so many times I notice that the truth or awakening, it's so many times I hear people conceptualize it in these kind of rather abstract, removed ways. For example, there can be this feeling or the sense that, oh, when I begin to wake up, that's when I'll really start to understand things, intellectually understand things. Or, oh, awakening or liberation is about some spiritual experience. Some experience that I'll have in meditation, or some state of mind that I'm going to acquire through meditation, and then I'm going to be there. It's true, there's some spiritual experiences that are important, but it's kind of missing the mark. The truth, or awakening, is about how we live our lives. So this is a different understanding of what the truth is or what liberation is. It's how I pick up this bowl. It's how I hold it. It's how I set it down. It's how I stand up. It's how I walk. It's how I speak to another person. It's how I relate to the breeze or to my breath. It's how I live my life, how I move forward in my life. That's really what awakening's about. And if that's what awakening is, then it's completely intertwined with ethical conduct. All ethics is how we live. So in some sense, there's no difference. Ethics and awakening, same thing. You see this actually start to emerge if you look at the history of Buddhism. Very much so in Chan Buddhism, which was the Buddhism that arose in China, which later turned into Zen Buddhism. There was a scholar of Chan Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, by the name of Peter Hirschhoff, and I thought he put this idea or this feeling of awakening, he put it into words very well. He said, it's not enough to see what Buddha nature is. You have to realize what Buddha nature does. So a lot of times in early Buddhism, there's an emphasis, which is important, which I'll be talking about more, of seeing clearly. But Chan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism took this a step further and to say, well, really what's enmeshed in seeing clearly is conduct, is moving forward, is acting in the world. There's actually no difference between seeing clearly and being a part of this world and acting in it. So it's not only seeing reality, the fundamental nature of reality. It's not only seeing Buddha nature, it's coming to get a sense of what it does, how it acts, how it moves in this world. In Dzogchen teachings of Tibetan Buddhism, you know, they talk a lot about the fundamental nature of mind, this open presence, which really is this wakefulness that one begins to rest in. And it said that what naturally arises out of that is compassionate action. Right? Compassion naturally emerges out of awakening. It's not something added to it, something that we have to do. It's the natural manifestation of an awake mind. I also want to point out that Buddhist ethics is not about following kind of the ideas of right and wrong and good and bad that we've acquired, for example, through our family or through our society that we've grown up with. Many times following, I think, an ethical code that leads to awakening, that leads to liberation, is going to go against a lot of these things that we've been told are good and bad or right and wrong. Right? So one example of this, this documentary might have come out a lot. I can't remember exactly when. It might have been in the late 80s. It was called An Act of Conscience. Did anybody see that documentary? It's about a couple in Massachusetts, and they refused to pay their taxes. And it was on the grounds of they didn't want to support any kind of military action. They didn't want any of their money to go to the military. And it was very interesting how they did this. They were actually very, very honest about it. So they would send in how much they made for that year. So they'd send in their tax forms of how much they made. And then they'd put a little letter with it, I think, that basically said, and we'll be giving this money to other organizations that we want to support. So it wasn't like they were lying about, you know, evading their taxes. They were very, I mean, this is why they got in trouble about it, because they were very honest about it. So there was a lot of honesty about it, and as a result, actually, they lost their home. The husband was sent to jail for a while. Actually, afterwards, they continued with it. But here's an example of two people of following what they thought was an ethical way of living that went against the grain of the society that they were living in. So maybe according to the laws of this country, it's not something that one should do, but to a deeper sense of ethics, it really fit. So again, we're not just following the society that we're living in when we take on a way of living that leads to awakening. Also in early Buddhism, what's emphasized around ethical conduct, when the Buddha spoke about ethical conduct, he spoke about intention. That what lies behind all of our actions is the state of mind that's there. Right? The intention behind the action gives the flavor of that action. And the story that's sometimes told about that is about a monk by the name of Moggallana, the Venerable Moggallana. And so there was one time where the Venerable Moggallana was walking along, and he was walking along and he was stepping on all of these ants, and a younger monk, you know, asked the Buddha about this. You know, isn't the Venerable Moggallana harming beings? Because non-harming is kind of the overall idea behind a lot of Buddhist ethics is this value of non-harming. And the Buddha said, well, actually, the Venerable Moggallana is not doing some kind of harmful action because he doesn't have the intention there, because he was blind. So the intention wasn't there, it was just that he was blind and he couldn't see that the ants were there. And as a result of that, it wasn't considered an unwholesome action. So what determined the quality of the action, again, was the intention. Does this make sense? And so especially in early Buddhism, that's really what's examined is intention. And what I want to propose tonight is that, yeah, it is very important to be aware of our intentions. But especially in this day and age, in our current times, what's also important is to cure those blindnesses that are there. Because so many times there can be these very wholesome intentions. And I'll give some examples of this as I go on. But there's a lot of blindness. And it's a kind of blindness that can be eradicated. So there also needs to be this intention to cure the blindness, to see clearly. So we need to go beyond merely intention. So I want to go back to September 11th for an example of this. And I want to speak more about what was going on inside the nation. And the reason I want to use September 11th is because I feel like some of the things that were going on after September 11th, especially in the weeks and months afterwards, kind of shows the underbelly of kind of the systemic suffering or oppression that happens in this country. So this will be an example, kind of an example of some of the blindnesses that we need to take a look at, kind of a systemic blindness. So just after September 11th, I think it was, they looked at the 2 weeks after September 11th. So in the 2 weeks after September 11th, there was over 1,000 hate crimes that were reported. Incredible. And so, you know, assault, murder, vandalism. And remember, these are the hate crimes that were reported. So there was this huge spike in hate crimes. And I don't think this happened merely because of this violent event of 9/11. I think it was something that was seething underneath in this country and still is in a lot of ways. It's just that 9/11 was this really this event that allowed some of this to seep out. You could say, you know, a lot of this violence was a lack of understanding of diversity. So I just want to give a few examples of this. So on September 12th, because I think this is quite striking, on September 12th there was a Sikh by the name of Sher Singh who was taking a train down to Rhode Island. And Sikhs wear turbans. Sikhs are not Muslim. And he was on the train and he gets to a stop, and all of a sudden he realizes, to his surprise, that there was many FBI agents that came flooding into his train compartment, pointing automatic assault weapons at him, and taking him into the police station. He hadn't done anything, and he was questioned, and 2 hours later he was let go. The man was not even a Muslim. He was wearing a turban. So he'd been taken in because of the way he looked. But also what happened from that is also what the media did with this. So how the media reported it was that there was a terror suspect that was taken in. And of course, TV being TV, what did people see? A person with a turban. So there's this gross misunderstanding of diversity. And there's actually many stories like this within the Sikh community, because the Sikhs are people who wear turbans. And just for your information, if you see a person with a turban in this country, 99.9% chance it's a Sikh, not someone who's Muslim. But because of the media, a lot of times the image, the ingrained image, is equating a turban with Islam. You know, so that was happening to the Sikh community, this lack of understanding. Really happened to most anyone with brown skin and black hair. To Indians, to Hindus. As I said, to Sikhs, to Latinos. It was something that was arising. Again, it was like the underbelly of this country was being shown. So I feel like if we're really committed to this path of waking up, to this path of liberation, really committed to non-harming, this is something that we need to address. And what a difficult thing to address, right? Because again, I'm talking about something that arises as a result of systems, a systemic kind of oppression. And 9/11 was just an example of this really blossoming out in so many different ways. And so these are kind of extreme examples, but I also want to point out that this happens even when we have good intentions. Some of you might know about this, but a couple of years ago at Spirit Rock, which is one of the big meditation centers in California, they decided to do a... have you heard about this? They decided to do a promotional video. So Spirit Rock did a promotional video. This is after they did a lot of diversity training. And the whole video only had white people in it. But there was a 2-second clip of an Asian American woman. And luckily, unfortunately, only the people of color that really wrote the first letters, saying something's going on here. And the response, which I think was true, is there was not an intention to discriminate. There wasn't that intention there. Right? There was real good intentions behind this video. I really think there were. And yet still, because of the system that we live in, there was discrimination happening. You could call it actually the subtle racism. Right? It was this neglect that was going on. And so this is the kind of blindness that I think we need to begin to pursue. And do you see how you can have these really clear, wholesome intentions, but still be blind? And it's a kind of blindness that we need to really address. And I think it's difficult. And so I want to take myself as an example about this and how this works. You know, so I'm American. See, these are the categories I want to point out to you. So these are dominant categories. I'm American. Being American is this dominant group of people in this world right now. I'm American. I'm white, or I'm seen as white. I'm male. I'm heterosexual. These are all these areas where there's a dominance or predominance in terms of the way society works. And no matter how nice of a guy I am, because I was brought up in this society or this culture, it is inevitable that I'm going to be blind to those things, right? That is what we're given. If you're in any of those groups, what you're given is blindness. That's really important to see. Because if you don't see that you're being given blindness by your upbringing, then you'll never be able to address it. And it's only by examining that, really putting forth the effort of examining what it's like to be in that position or the dynamic, that systemic dynamic, that can start to be eradicated. Is this making sense? Blindness is what we're given. It's not something that we acquire, and if we don't put forth the effort to examine it, it's still going to be there. This is really important. Because I think a lot of times the argument is, I didn't mean to, which is true. Again, there's that good intention. But there hasn't been the effort to really examine the dynamic of oppression or around diversity. And it's important to see that this is kind of the dynamic of this subtle oppression in a sense. Right? And just a couple of examples of this. I can walk down the street holding the hand of my girlfriend and never think about it. Basically in any city in the world, I can do that. If I was gay or lesbian, I would always be thinking about that. Right? When I write a check, use my credit card, I have never thought or had to worry that my financial reliability would be judged upon my skin color, right? I don't have to think about that. So it's these things that I don't have to think about that I need to think about. Again, this is the kind of blindness that needs to be cured. So I invite you to be aware of those areas where you've been given a blindness of some sort. It's making sense, because a lot of times this kind of oppression is very subtle. It can go by the wayside. And we can't know everything about everybody or everything. I'm not talking about that. All I'm talking about is the openness and the curiosity so that we can move forward. I still have a lot to say. I'm seeing if I should cut stuff out. Okay, I'm going to try to go quickly. So the other cool thing about this is that mindfulness actually can really help facilitate this. Because one of the things that we're doing with mindfulness is that we're actually starting to cultivate this ability to differentiate. Because a lot of times a lack of seeing these things is a lack of being able to see differentiation. So even when I'm sitting here paying attention to the feeling of my abdomen rising and falling, one of the things that we want to be sensitive to is that the rising of the abdomen feels different than the falling of the abdomen. The sound arises and it passes away. Right? There's all these unique flavors to our experience, and it allows our mind to really see things the way they are and to conceptualize less upon our experience. So it's these big concepts that we bring to our experience that can really facilitate or lead to this oppression that I'm talking about. So it's training the mind in the right direction. Yeah. So I want to go on to another example, and that's the environment. Again, we can have all these intentions to care about the environment, but again, we are given a blindness to the degradation that their actions have on the environment. It's inbuilt. It's inbuilt to the system. And again, this is just another area where we have to have this openness, this curiosity about what kind of suffering comes out of our actions. And it can be difficult in terms of the environment, because a lot of times our actions are going to be on the individual level rather negligible. Right? Driving a car across town, actually, in the whole scheme of things, is not going to make a big difference globally. Collectively, it does. Right? I think there's a deeper root to the ecological crisis or the environmental problem. And actually, it was spoken about. Some of you might know this. Some of you that are into this, the whole environmental thing, might know about this essay that was written. Is it written in the late 60s by a professor by the name of Lynn White? And it was called The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis. And what he was really looking at is, what are the attitudes underlying our relationship to ecology that allows us for this destruction to happen? It's an interesting article. And what he basically boils down to is, he says, the prevailing attitude that allows this to happen is there's this attitude that human beings and nature are two different things. So that's one axiom. We're two different things. We got nature, we got human beings. It's the way we see the world. And then the other axiom that goes with that is that human beings are their master of nature. And from that, hey, we can do what we want to do. Right? Makes it very easy. So that's what he was advocating, is we really got to examine these axioms. And I think that's the cool thing about meditation, is we start to have an experience that's different than those axioms. We start to get a taste of non-separation. Rather being these separate beings, we get more of a taste of non-separation, right? And I'm sure some of you have experienced that in your meditation. A different outlook than me and you, or nature's out there and here I am. It can be very immediate. I mean, even right now, like if you're sitting here right now, and I invite you to do this, here you are, you're sitting in your chair, and you can probably feel the support of the chair or the support of the floor. Right? You can feel the weight of your body. Really, what's that experience of the weight of your body, though? Really, what is that? It's really about relationship. It's the relationship your body has to the earth. It's gravitational pull. If the earth wasn't there, you wouldn't be feeling any weight. So in some ways, you're not feeling your body. What you're feeling is relationship to this whole earth. That's the experience of weight. Relationship. Your connection with nature. When you experience the breath, it's not this separate experience. It's completely intertwined with the air, with atmospheric pressure, the balance of oxygen and carbon dioxide. We're not separate. And when we start to set aside these concepts, we can really start to taste that. And when we allow ourselves to actually taste that and to feel that, we can start to move in the world differently. We can start to relate to the environment in a radically different way. Again, here's this blindness. Sometimes we carry around these axioms that are built on blindness. And so we need to do something more than just have a wholesome intention. It's to have a deeper sense, a more real sense, a true sense of a relationship to the world. To go beyond this blindness of this superficial view. So a couple of things that I want to encourage you to remember while you're exploring, you know, how to move forward in this world. The first one is we're imperfect and we're swimming upstream. We live in an environment that we're going against, in a society that we're going against in this way. It's difficult to care about the environment where our main mode of transportation is a car. Of course, it's great when we take steps in that measure, but it's going to be difficult. And as a result of that, it's important to see that we're imperfect, and that's the quality of it. And again, the Buddha, I feel like, really spoke to this. You know, when he talks about the precepts or these moral, this code of ethical conduct, the word he used, and some of you will know this, you know, any of you have been on a retreat with like Theravada monastics, you might remember some of the Pali that was used for the precepts. And one of the words in that is Sika Padang. So Pana Tipata Veramini Sika Padang Samadhyami. Samadhyami means I undertake. And then Sika Padang comes from Sika Pada, which means the training. I'm undertaking a training. I'm not committing myself to a commandment or a rule. I'm going to train myself some way. I think this is really important to remember in terms of ethics. When I train to, like, for example, learn to play the piano, I'm going to make a lot of mistakes. And I'm going to be rather clumsy at it. That's what training is, right? And then gradually there's a little more fluidity in my fingers. And then this grace comes. This grace. And then the music really comes. But it comes from training. Training usually that's kind of messy. Right? It's so important to remember this. This is not about... So this is quite different. This is not about rules. It's not about commandments. It's about undertaking a training. And what we're promised or given is a grace to our actions. And also what's needed in order to undertake a training is, again, this curiosity, this openness. What works when I'm playing the piano? What feels better? What doesn't feel better? So it's playing around with it. So it doesn't have this rigidity to it. So that's one thing to remember. The other thing I want to point out that also comes up around ethical conduct or living an ethical life is shame. Shame is not so effective, I've found, in my life. Maybe you found it effective in your life. So what I mean by shame, and I want to distinguish this from regret. I think there is a place for regret. When I regret something that I did, oops, I shouldn't have said that. Maybe I can do it differently next time. Regret really can be useful, right? But regret is different than shame. Regret is, oh, oops, I did that. I said that thing. Oops, I did that. wouldn't, I don't want to do that again. Shame is not only did I do that, but something's wrong with me. I'm no good. I'm bad. I'm bad for doing that. That's shame. Shame is paralyzing. Right? Because what we've done is we've identified with the action, and we've not allowed ourselves to actually be imperfect. And then there's a paralysis that arises from that. We've come to identify with that. Ethics is not about identifying with. It's not about, oh, I'm so good because I'm leading an ethical life. It's not about that. It's not about, oh, I'm so bad because I'm not leading an ethical life. That's identifying. It's not about elevating the self. It's not about degrading the self. It's not about that. It's about becoming open and curious and undergoing a training. A couple more things about this that I want to go into. And that's, I think, and this is the most important thing. This is really what I wanted to talk about tonight. And I finally got to it. This is what I'm really excited about. So, what's most important about living an ethical life is actually opening our hearts. It's opening our hearts to the suffering in the world. The image that always strikes me is, and this especially comes out in the Lotus Sutras, is this Bodhisattva Kuan Yin or Avalokiteshvara. She's referred to as the hearer of the cries of the world. So she's that being who opens her heart, who hears the cries of the world. And that moves her heart to act. So it's a movement of the heart that needs to be behind our actions. So that's really what's needed, is that feeling. And the Buddha talks about this. It was interesting that usually when the Buddha talked about compassion, he'd use this word karuna, the Pali word karuna. But there was another word that he used for it called anukampa, which meant literally, which I find so fascinating, it's when the heart trembles or shakes with. So it's to tremble with or shake with. That's what the verb means. So it's to tremble or shake with the suffering of the world. And it's from there one acts. So he used this word when he said to his monks, please go out into the world and teach. Teach the Dharma for the welfare of the world. So it's this trembling with. It's a movement of the heart. And when I say this, I'm not saying that we should just completely open ourselves up to suffering in a way that we collapse. But it's having an understanding of how much we can handle so that we're still responsive. That's really important, especially around the media and around news. Lots of news, not good. But the other reason I want to point this out, and I want to go along this vein, is that so many times, most of the time, and this is very true of Buddhism too, is that ethics is talked about in terms of inhibition. Restraint. So even in the Pali, I was talking about, viramani means to refrain from. And restraint is important. What's more important, so inhibition can be important. What's more important than inhibition is disinhibition. Especially in Vipassana communities. I think the more people I meet that practice Vipassana, the more I realize it is more a problem of disinhibition than of inhibition. There's too much inhibition, and there needs to be more disinhibition. Don't you agree? And that's really what's needed for ethical conduct, is it to disinhibit the heart to actually authentically respond, not to inhibit. And I'm not saying we shouldn't practice restraint. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I'm pretty safe saying that you probably need some more disinhibition in terms of that. Of really allowing the heart to feel and then to move forward with that. Because if it's only inhibition, usually what arises from that, if ethics is governed by inhibition, then what that centers around usually is a lot of times of shoulds. Oh, I should be doing this. I should speak like this because I want to be a good Buddhist. And I shouldn't speak like this because I don't want to be seen that way. And then there's this restrictive quality to acting. Right? It's all about what I should do and what I shouldn't do. What looks good, what doesn't look good. You know? What I ought to be doing. And that is a whole different feeling than being so moved by your heart that you're led to act. Do you get the different sense there? It's important. Because we're talking about liberation. When you just get a sense, even a felt sense right now of liberation, do you think of restriction or flow? Flow. So if ethics is only about restriction, we might be missing something. Not only might, we are. So I think we all move forward to ethical living that leads to the liberation of all beings. Thank you. Any questions, comments? Two things to that. I think we know we're going over the edge because we usually, when we've gone over the edge, it's because a lot of times we'll get lost in things like blaming and or collapse where we feel like we can't move forward or an apathy. So that can be an indication of it being too much. And what's needed is more capacity for that in a sense. But that initial response is actually a good response. Actually, Joanna Macy, this is the other thing I was going to point out. Some of you might know the writings of Joanna Macy. She talks about that pain that we feel. This is especially around environment and ecological crisis, that the pain that we feel when we see environmental degradation, the pain that we feel, you know, when we see the more than human world suffering, is really the beginning of the heart moving. And it's starting with that pain that usually is overwhelming and then gaining capacity so that we can move forward. But that initial feeling is a good feeling. Just we need a little more capacity. And we know we don't have enough capacity if we feel like, yeah, we are collapsing. Or, you know, a lot of times I think other indications is if I'm really getting lost in blaming somebody else or blaming myself and I'm not moving forward, or this self-righteousness, I'm right, you're wrong kind of thing, I think it's a lack of capacity of really to really be with the suffering. Does that kind of help give you?
What came up for me when you were reading, especially Beacon, Jesus, was this movement of engaged Buddhism.
Yeah.
Where people, I think it's starting to catch fire, you know, in this country, because we've been practicing our little zendos and our little meditation groups, you know, and now I think we have our foundation enough that we can engage, like in the peace movement. Suffering when we see it.
Yeah, and actually, there's another part in the essay that's what he speaks to. Is he's really saying, yeah, here is this aspect of Buddhism, engaged Buddhism. It's really trying to move forward in this way that you're talking about. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.